families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign. With plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number one of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about a couple of basic questions. The first being, what sort of skills will American workers need to be competitive in the future and for the American economy to be competitive in the future? And then the second question is, what kind of educational system do we need to give workers those skills? We will be talking this morning about the proposals of a panel called the New Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. They put out a report in December, making some very far-ranging, some people would say radical, recommendations on redesign for the American educational system. This is a panel that had as its members two former federal education secretaries, two former labor secretaries, the former governor of Michigan, the New York City schools chancellor, and others. So it was a diverse, bipartisan panel with people from the worlds of education, from labor, and from public policy. And if you're interested, by the way, in taking a look at the executive summary of the report, you can do that by going to the website of the National Center on Education and the Economy. That's skillscommission.org. If you put that into your browser there, you can take a look at that. And then, of course, you can get the full report from them if that's really what you want to do. Here in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Mark Tucker. He's the president of the National Center on Education and the Economy. He is also the vice chairman and the staff director of the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can certainly join the conversation. We just ask people to be brief as possible just so that we can keep things moving along. But of course, anyone who is listening to us this morning would be welcome to call. Mr. Tucker, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Do you, perhaps let's just, I'll have you talk just generally about the new commission. This is now the second report like this that you have done. The first one was about 15, 16 years ago, I think. Tell us just a little bit about how it is that this commission come together and to make these recommendations.
Well, the first report we issued in 1990 was based, as this one was, on 2 years of research all over the globe on the global economy and its implications for education in the United States. And we concluded in the report that we issued in 1990 something very simple. It seems commonsensical now, but it was news then, and that was this, that what we saw happening was that the United States, low-skilled people in the United States were for the first time in direct competition with low-skilled people in countries overseas that were much poorer than the United States, and in which those people were therefore willing to work for much less. And we concluded then in 1990 that the United States had two choices. We could either compete for the low-skill work, which would mean driving our wages down to those of the competition, or we could largely abandon most of our low-skilled work and do what other countries, industrialized countries, were doing, which is raise our standards for the kids in the bottom half of the distribution and go after the high value-added products and services that would lead to a much better paying jobs. That seemed like a simple, straightforward, and powerful analysis, we had, however, never even imagined what was becoming clear to us a couple of years ago, and that was that for the first time, the United States was in competition with two countries, China and India, and others coming along, which could offer very highly skilled people coming out of its schools at very low wages. We had never imagined that possibility. and large numbers of them, too. So now it seems that the United States is competing with low-skilled people elsewhere who are willing to work for much less, people with intermediate skills elsewhere who are willing to work for much less, and people with very high skills who are willing to work for much less. That's a whole new challenge.
Yeah.
And requires a whole new response.
Well, the ideal here, the object would be, as you say, would be to produce a highly educated, highly skilled workforce that is ready to compete in on offering these high-value services. The problem, as you have pointed out, and I think that other people have pointed out as well, is that the school system that we have is still, the way that it's organized is still geared towards the old economy, not the one that we are either in particularly or the one that we seem to be moving toward. And so for that reason, we are falling behind other countries in our ability to produce really top people, people who have those kind of skills.
The problem is actually even more difficult than what you just summarized. If we were able simply to match the mathematics performance of the kids coming out of the top of the Indian system, which is an enormous challenge, we're nowhere close. We would then simply qualify to earn the wages that those young people are earning in India. And beginning engineers in the United States make about $45,000 a year. Beginning engineers in India make about $7,500 a year. So we've not only got to match their performance, but we've got somehow to do something they're not doing if we're going to have wages that are going to be much higher than theirs. If we can't figure out how to do that, we are going to suffer a long, slow, but steep decline in the American standard of living.
Well, that's a rather shocking kind of prediction where you say that even if we can strengthen the system that we have and turn out workers with skills and performance that are competitive, you still could be looking at ultimately a decline in wages and standard of living of American workers. That's even if we make things significantly better, even if we improve the performance of the system that we have significantly more than we have now, we could still be looking at a significant decline in wages and living standards.
Unless we can both match their academic performance, a tall order, and do something they can't do or haven't been able to do thus far. That's right. And so we asked ourselves, you know, if wages generally are going down across the board for all skill levels, what kind of work and workers are employers in the future going to be willing to pay high wages for? That turned out to be a central question in our analysis, and the answer that we came up with is actually fairly straightforward. Firms that make products or offer services that are in enormous demand and that can't be obtained from any other firm are going to be able to pay high wages to the people who work for them. And actually, they won't have much choice because the kinds of people that enable them to produce a steady series of new products and new services that are highly desirable and can't be obtained anywhere else are going to cost them a lot of money. So they'll both be able to pay a lot of money to those people, and they won't have a choice. They'll have to. And basically, what we concluded was that our whole economy is going to have to be full of firms that answer to that description, that is, are producing a steady stream of highly desirable products and services that can be obtained from no other firm. And because companies all over the world are getting very adept at copying the leaders and doing it quickly, any company that has a strategy like that has got to have its next product or service in its back pocket even after it's releasing its first. And so if you stand back from that and you say, well, if that's a formula for paying high wages for a company or even, in fact, for an entire economy, why should they choose American workers to do that? And the answer is they will only do that if our workers are among the world's very best educated, that is, have among the highest academic performance, number one. Number two, they are among the most creative and innovative in the world. And number three, they can learn faster than anybody else in the world. And this is, by the way, this is not just a prescription for the folks in the corner office who run the company or design its products. If you look at the Apple iPod, it's a product which is creative and innovative in its technology, in the way it is sold, in its marketing strategy, in the way it's manufactured, in product design, in industrial design. Virtually every aspect of that product is creative and innovative, and it requires those kinds of skills and levels of abilities of people up and down the line, including on the production line. So that's what we that's a very tall order, but that's, I believe, what we have to do in order to make sure we don't suffer an across-the-board decline in our standard of living over the coming years.
Well, let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Mark Tucker. He is president of the National Center on Education and the Economy. It's been in existence since 1989, and it was brought into being to address these very issues that we're talking about, how it is that we develop a kind of highly skilled workforce that will be able to compete internationally. He also is the vice chairman and the staff director of the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. It's a panel that's made up of a number of rather distinguished people, among them two former secretaries of education, two former secretaries of labor, the former governor of Michigan, the chancellor of the New York City schools, and some other folks. So people who are involved in labor issues and education in public policy. And the commission put out a report last December, so just a couple of months ago, setting out their recommendations for changes in public education in the United States that would get us to this point of being able to produce the kind of workers that we will need for the future. And as I mentioned, if you go to their website and go to the website of the National Center on Education and the Economy, you can read the executive summary of the report. And then if you would like to have the full report, you can also get it from them. Questions are welcome here, too. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I want to go and give you an opportunity to talk about some of the things that you and the commission recommends. And I guess that perhaps we'll try and take some of these things in order. I suppose the one of the big things right up front is that you believe that almost everybody, or perhaps we shouldn't say almost everybody, is going to have some kind of post-secondary education. Everybody might not go in the same track, and they might not start at the same time, but that everyone, even people who have been in the workforce for a while, there have to be those kinds of opportunities for something beyond high school.
Actually, that's a conclusion that almost all American labor economists have come to over the last 10 years, that people, in order to be able to support a family in the United States in the years ahead, are going to have at least 2 years of college. We took that idea and said, let's make it real. Mm-hmm. And we looked at our research. Basically, our recommendations are made on the basis of benchmarking research that we did all over the world. And so as you go through them, you'll find that we've taken the best ideas, the best practices from the most successful countries in education everywhere. And we started off by looking at a number of countries, particularly in Northern Europe, that are very successful at sending almost all of their high school graduates off to what we would call college, ready to do college-level work, not at the age of 18, but at the age of 16. And so we said, as a design specification, let us start with the idea that we would have 60% of our high school kids ready to go to college and do college-level work at the age of 16, and that 95% of our kids would be ready to do college-level work before they left high school, that is, by the time they were 18. That was our design specification, and we said, furthermore, let's have a very good test, not the kind of test that we're using in our accountability systems now, but much better ones. And let's use those tests to find out whether our kids are ready for college without remediation. And as soon as they're able to pass it, let them go. So we don't have a time in the seat system anymore. We have a system that says as soon as you're ready, you can go on to the next stage of your education. That's what we propose to do.
How do you, just very quickly here, let me raise the issue of if we're going to go, if everybody's going to go to some kind of post-secondary education, mm-hmm. that either they're going to go at that point when they're at the 10th grade, if they can do it, they may be going to a junior college, they may be going into some kind of very advanced technical education, mm-hmm. they might even be ready at that point to go to a four-year university and start on a four-year degree.
Yeah.
That's all. An awful lot of people going into a system that where one of the increasing challenges is to figure out how it is we pay for people, or people do pay for it. How do we make it possible for all of those people who are going to be going into post-secondary education to pay for it?
That actually is a question we did not directly address. And the reason that is true is because this is a report about elementary and secondary education. We did not want to take on the whole of the higher education systems problems, which are on the same scale of complexity as those of the elementary and secondary system. However, if you do what I just suggested as a design criteria, if you start with the assumption that we would be successful in educating our high school kids up to a standard of ready for college without remediation, 60% of them by the age of 16, it turns out you save an awful lot of money. And we had the best school finance experts in the country figure out exactly how much. You save it partly by what's saved on the kids going, leaving high school before they now do, not being in their junior and senior years in high school. And also, you save all of the money that we're currently spending on remedial courses in college, which is a great deal of money. When you add those two together, it comes to about $60 billion, with a B. Mm-hmm. And we subtracted from that $60 billion, $10 billion, which is the cost of having kids stay in high school who are now dropping out, who would succeed against the standard that we're talking about. When you take that $10 billion that it would cost to do that, you reduce our savings to $50 billion. And we added to that $8 billion. We just threw it in. It's a very small fraction of the $500 billion that we spend on elementary and secondary education today. And that gave us an investment fund of $58 billion, which we then spent in our imaginary accounting procedure in order to make sure that we could plausibly bring 60% of our kids up to the point where they would be ready for a college-level education by the age of 16. So we actually made a budget. We did what very few commissions ever do. We figured out what it would cost to implement our recommendations, and we showed how we could actually get that money, everything that would be needed to reach that objective, at a very slight incremental cost to the whole by redeploying the dollars that we're already spending. If we actually did this and we succeeded and not one more student went to college than does now, it would still be a smashing success for the United States, because we could basically, for pretty much the same money we're now spending now, greatly improve the result for our kids.
Let's take some calls. We have some people who want to join the conversation, and we'll start with someone in a community not too far away from us here, Rantoul, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if your report has any recommendations for gifted children.
Actually, our recommendations, we believe that if the recommendations in our report were followed, the results would be much better for gifted children, for kids who are in the middle, and for kids who now are at the bottom in terms of measured ability. Because among the things that we would do is we would, excuse me, as I said earlier, we would have a foundational level of education that would be much, much higher than the current eighth grade level, which is the highest level that the states now require for high school graduation. That's for all kids. And we would say to kids, we would get you through the system as fast as you're prepared to go. For the kids who did especially well on the high school leaving examination that I just briefly described a minute ago, mm-hmm. they could stay in high school and enroll in an international baccalaureate program, a program made up of AP courses, advanced placement courses, a comparable program put together by the University of Cambridge, their International General Certificate of Secondary Education exam. These are all very, as you probably know, very demanding examination programs that are essentially set up to enable kids to compete for selective admissions to colleges. And I think this would be an enormous boon for kids who are what we call gifted in this country. But it would also provide enormous opportunities for all the other kids, too.
Well, one follow-up to that, if a child is gifted, do you think at some point corporations that are on a cutting edge like Google should take the responsibility to fund gifted children's educations if they really want these children to develop? Because school districts like here in Rantoul, they don't put a lot of money into gifted kids.
Well, I don't know that it is the direct responsibility of our corporations to educate our kids. We've never thought that in the United States, and I think it's the public's responsibility to do that. It's the single best investment we can make in our own future. However, Intel picked up the baton from Westinghouse to create continue to fund, in effect, the science competitions that are so attractive to so many of our kids who are gifted in the area of mathematics and science. And I think our corporations do have a responsibility to do what they can along those lines. But I don't regard that as a substitute for the public responsibility to make sure that we're making the most of our kids' potential.
And if I understand what you're saying correctly, we need less lawyers and more engineers.
I didn't say that.
No, but I'm just trying to read between the lines.
If our economic analysis is right, the United States is going to have to be a number one or number two technology leader in almost every industry in which it competes, and that is going to take the best scientific and mathematical and engineering and technical leadership in the world on a much larger scale than we've been able to mount thus far. We are now producing about 60,000 engineers a year, and India and China combined are producing about 135,000, if you use the word engineer in the same way to describe both categories. And their numbers are increasing rapidly. Ours actually include a number of students from other countries who used to stay here and made an enormous contribution in the United States, but who are now going back to their countries of origin. So We could be in considerable trouble if we proceed on the path we're currently on.
I agree. This is a national security issue, in my opinion.
It is.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, we have some others, and let us go next to line number two, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. I want to preface my remarks by saying that I absolutely believe in the importance of education. That is important, but in terms of addressing this problem of job flight and having living incomes, we're not going to solve that problem if we don't address the politics of the situation. So too often this whole discussion seems to act as if the job flight out of the country is an inevitable march of nature, and it's just something that happens by the invisible hand of Adam Smith or something. But in fact, besides our agreements such as the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and GATT and all that, I mean, we're even subsidizing corporations to dismantle factories and facilities here in this country and move them offshore. So, and until we address the reality that, our political economy works in favor of capital over, the importance of community, education's not going to be enough to get it done because, I mean, humans are intelligent and creative wherever they are. And ultimately, people in other places, if they are forced to, you know, drive wages down to the bottom, they're going to be able to compete with us eventually, you know, regardless of what we do in terms of education here locally.
There are a whole set of issues having to do with trade policy that that our commission did not get into. It's not that we weren't aware of them, but we were not set up to deal with them at any level of specificity. And I understand some of the references you're making, and I think we need to address those issues. But at a larger level, I think if you had been with me when we were spending weeks in India, trying to understand what was going on in this country, you would have been as impressed as I was with the incredible hunger for education in that country. We visited some, we use the word slums in this country, but they have no analog to what you find in India. You haven't seen poverty until you've seen India. And yet you would walk through those slums and there would be signs in every alleyway in English for education. The worst poverty in India is in the countryside, and there in the countryside, these Indian farmers who have almost no rupees are actually using some of them to buy private education for their kids. They're so desperate to get them out of their circumstances. My point is that were we to address all of the problems that you refer to, we would still be in a situation in which there are poor people in this world who are fighting with every fiber of their energy to get as well educated as they can possibly be, who are going to be willing to work for less than Americans are, who are fighting for their education far less hard than they are. And those people are going to be available to employers all over the world by the Internet, as they are now. And there's nothing we can do to prevent that. We need to address the issues that you're talking about, but in the last analysis, what we see all over the world now is that what you make is much more a function of what you know and can do than it has ever been before. And if we don't get really serious about doing everything we can possibly do to raise the education and skills of our kids, we're going to lose no matter what the trade policies are.
I need to jump in here because we're past our midpoint. I have another caller. I want to thank the last one for his comments and introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in last 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. Our guest is Mark Tucker. He is the president of the National Center on Education and the Economy that came into being in 1989 to address the issue that he has talked about here, and that is concerns that American schools just aren't producing people with the kind of skills that make them competitive in today's global economy. He is also the vice chairman and staff director of the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. This is a commission that includes two former federal education secretaries, one Republican, one Democrat, two former labor secretaries, former governor of Michigan, the New York City schools chancellor, some other people from education, labor, public policy areas that came together to produce a report that was released in December in which they make a series of very wide-ranging recommendations about changes in public education here in the United States. And if you're interested in reading the executive summary so you can get some idea about what they have recommended, you can go to the website of the National Center on Education and the Economy, and you can see it there. And other questions, of course, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I think that next we'll talk with someone in Urbana and line number 3. Hello.
Hello, yes. My question is for the kids who, you know, if intelligence is on a bell curve from highly intelligent to low intelligence on the non-college side of that bell curve, it seems like, you know, there's going to be a lot of children who simply, you know, due to luck of genetics or whatever, aren't endowed to go to college and certainly not to compete in the type of companies you talk of that have to be the Apple iPods every 6 months coming out. And, you know, as we talk, you know, this is something like Lake Wobegon, where every child's above average. And it seems like people who, you know, the jobs that people, you know, who would need, you know, know, non-college jobs are quickly being replaced either by technology, so we don't need to hire as many of them. They're being exported to Mexico or imported via, or we're importing illegal immigrants as much as we like to demonize them these days. Or simply, you know, like the old VCR repairman, now we just throw away our VCRs and buy a new one. So what's your answer for those kids?
Well, you're certainly right. First of all, there are jobs and will continue to be jobs that require no more than a low level of skills, people making beds in hotels and working on our garbage trucks and so on. But and it is also, I think, true that, on the other hand, as you say, for every job that we're losing to outsourcing, we're losing more than 10 to automation. And those jobs are not always, by the way, low-skill jobs. But they tend more to be low-skill jobs than otherwise. And that's why it is our view that on balance, we're going to need many more much higher educated people than we do now if we're going to have a successful economy. Your question appears to be, is that realistic given a bell curve of natural ability? Aren't all those people on the tail of the curve on the left, that is the low end of the ability spectrum, how are they going to be able to get to high standards? What we're proposing is that this country actually duplicate the performance of some other countries that appear to be doing that. And it's hard to imagine why we cannot do that unless you believe that the distribution of intelligence in the United States is lower than that in other countries with which we compete. The reality, I think, and there's a lot of research to back this statement up, is that we have consistently underestimated the abilities of our kids. Again and again, what you see in the research coming from Asia is that the Asians believe that academic achievement is largely the result not of natural ability but of effort, and they have set up a system based on that assumption. The United States has set up a system that's based on the assumption that academic performance is largely the result of natural ability. Our teachers tend to estimate natural ability fairly low for a large fraction of our kids and give them in the early years, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and third grade, a curriculum that is relatively undemanding as a result. That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't build up kids' vocabulary in the early years in school, they will in fact be unable to do the work in the later years of school, and that's exactly what happens in this country. But if you look at other countries, particularly in Asia, that assume that the difference is made by effort, not ability, you'll see that they expect much more of their kids. And guess what? They get it. That's the story over and over and over again, all over the world in the research I've seen. You raise the expectations, and the kids meet them. I don't mean to stratospheric levels, but we're not talking about stratospheric levels.
Well, just to make sure also that people who are listening understand here, in the kinds of recommendations that this commission makes extends all the way back down the educational road to the point where you're saying if we're going to get to the point where actually 95% of 10th graders can go on to post-secondary education and be successful, what has to happen is we're going to have to strengthen elementary education. It's going to have to be better. We're going to have better teachers. It's going to have to be more rigorous. And also you're recommending that high-quality early childhood education also be available as well, so that we need to start sooner with kids who are 3 and 4, and that what we're going to have to do is improve things. All if we're going to get that level of success when kids are sophomores in high school, their performance, their education, the quality of what they get is going to have to be dramatically improved all the way back to the point where they're just a couple of years old.
If you don't mind my taking just a minute, I'll just quickly review a couple of the recommendations
sure, yeah.
we made. I said a few minutes ago that if you assume that kids are going to be, the majority of our kids are going to go off to college at the age of 16, and you throw in a little extra money, you have an investment fund of about $58 billion, which you can invest in measures that would actually make make it possible for that to happen. And we invested that money in the following way. We invested over $19 billion in early childhood education, which would enable us to provide a high-quality early childhood education to all four-year-olds and all low-income three-year-olds. This is crucially important because what the research shows is that our low-income kids enter kindergarten with roughly half the vocabulary of the other kids. That is an educational death sentence. We took the next $19-plus billion and we invested it in basically teachers' compensation. That would enable us to attract most of our teachers from the top third of the kids entering colleges in the United States. It would make an enormous difference in teacher quality. We took the last third and invested it in a whole new education finance system, which would be far more equitable than the one we have now, and among other things, enable us to spend a lot more money than we do now on kids who need that money the most to get to a high level of academic standards. Those are just a few of the things that we recommended. There are others that are no less dramatic.
Let's talk with someone else. Let's go next to Urbana for another caller. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I want to thank the station and the guest for his the report on his excellent study. But other guests interviewed on this station have pointed out that the leadership, especially at the national level, has other ideas. And some of the more extreme members of the leadership aren't even interested in public education. They think homeschooling is the be-all and end-all of basic education. He's up against other people who have done sufficient things so that a book called The Republican War on Science was generated just a couple of years ago. And he's up against the president's formally introduced plan called No Child Left Behind, which my own sister, who teaches high school in Minnesota, thinks is a flat-out attack on public education. So what are you going to do with all that against you, sir?
We never said it would be easy. It won't. This commission proposed a set of ideas which have been widely characterized, in fact, by themselves as well as others, as radical. But they are all proposals for a public education system. They're all focused on education that takes place in schools. Every member of this commission, Republican and Democrat, believe that what we need are public schools, not a way to fund private schools and not a way to fund homeschooling.
Well, you've got my vote on that, but like I say...
I understand there are people with other views, but I think you're going to find very broad support for the propositions I just laid out. It won't be unanimous, but we've gotten, despite the boldness of these proposals, or maybe because of them, we've gotten an enormous positive reaction from many, many quarters to the proposals that we laid out, much more so than we had ever imagined possible. I might say that this commission, which is really a commission, this is not using the word in a pejorative way, of the establishment, it's certainly not people who anybody would call radicals, came to its views because... as they said during the commission meetings, one by one, they said, you know, we've been at this as individuals for 20, 25, 30 years, putting our heart and soul into it. And at the end of the day, what we have is a system which performs not much better than it did when we started all those years ago, and now costs 2.5 times as much as it did 30 years ago. And they said, you know, something's got to change. I think that many of the things that you just talked about are responses to a set of frustrations that people have with the way the public education system has performed. And those frustrations are very real. We now have the second highest cost elementary and secondary education system in the world, and it's one of the worst performing. So there's an objective basis for the frustrations. And what I'm saying is that I think when people are presented with a set of ideas for saving the public education system, albeit with a lot of important changes, I think you're going to find that they are not going to be quite so eager to abandon the public education system. That's what we're finding.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I would just again like to introduce our guest, Mark Tucker. He is president of the National Center on Education and the Economy. He's also vice chairman, staff director of the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. The commission issued a report in December, in which they make this very dramatic series of recommendations on reform of public education. And if you're interested in taking a look at the executive summary, you can go to their website. And probably the best way to do it would be to go to skillscommission.org. Or I think probably if people go to the website of the National Center on Education and the Economy, and they can get there to take a look at the report. I'm assuming they can, Mark.
They can.
All right.
Either way.
Either way. Let's talk with some other folks here. And next, I think we have someone nearby in the community of Belgium. This will be line number two. We'll go there. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to interject into this discussion the aspect that we have totally neglected vocational education anymore. A skill set that is totally lost anymore to people. You can hardly find a kid that can read a ruler, let alone a tape measure. And I have to highly recommend a small community by the name of Shiloh that is south of Champaign, I think, who happens to have a very good vocational program that's recognized in the woodworking industry all over the United States as being very progressive. And it's something that we've totally forgotten about. Here's a skill set that is very valuable, but nobody teaches it. You have to get it from another individual. You can go to very famous schools like North Bennett in Boston or RIT in Northern New York or some places in California and find some skill sets. But for the most part, local school districts do not provide anymore, mainly because of the liability from sharp pieces of equipment that bite, that people don't want to be involved with. But other than that, it's a shame that we're losing these skill sets.
Well, I totally agree with the caller, and it's one of the things that that we focused on. One of the reasons this has happened is because our high schools have for years not been able to afford either the equipment or the trained technical personnel to run vocational education programs that would provide economically valuable skills to people. It's no longer enough to teach kids auto shop with a couple of old jalopies and a handful of hand tools. You need millions of dollars worth of equipment. And what is true for auto shop is true for one occupation after another. It's one of the reasons that we suggested that we provide a very strong foundation of education to our kids, enabling them to go to an academic or a vocational program in a community or technical college at the age of 16. The institutions that can afford the kind of equipment and personnel needed to teach economically valuable vocational skills to kids are not in our high schools. They're in our community and technical colleges.
If I might point out, sir, I take exception with that. There's a program that's taught in Norway and Sweden called the SOLID program, and they teach a lot of values, a lot of ways to handle things. You never use much more than a sharp knife. Also at this time, they teach a lot of things about mathematics and deduction and logic, and it's been used earlier in the 20th century, 1910s, 20s, and it's very, very popular in Europe for a long time, and we've just totally forgot it. And it taught a lot of skill sets that are useful in very many sources of life, very many aspects of life, I should say, more than that. But
those are, I'm familiar with the program. I think it's fair to say the most admired country in Europe right now with respect to vocational education is Denmark. And the Danes teach their vocational programs in their business and technical colleges. The business and technical colleges enroll kids coming right out of focus school. Those kids leave school after 10 years of education and go to those institutions. It's precisely the model that I'm talking about. There are things that can be taught with a penknife, but you won't be a qualified auto mechanic if all you've had experience with is a penknife. I take the point that you're making, that I take you to be making, that there are things that you can teach with a minimum of equipment that would be valuable for kids to know that are not taught in most of our schools. I agree with that. But that's not the same thing as providing kids with a set of skills which will enable them to earn a living coming right out of college, out of school. And that's what I'm talking about. I think we're doing a really poor job of that now, and it's getting poorer every year.
I want to thank the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to try to get at least one more caller in here. Let's go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, to continue your conversation on vocational education, I grew up in New York State in the 60s and 70s when I went to school, and there were programs like this. We had I had schoolmates that would go off and actually be bused to a vocational school where they go do auto mechanics or some type of skilled labor. But then there was also the Regents program,
mm-hmm.
where you could, if you were going to be college-bound, then you took a set of different math classes and science classes, and you got a diploma, a Regents diploma, as well as your high school diploma, and that was your ticket to college.
Right.
And that's where I was able to get into college without really having to take an ACT, because coming to Illinois, I had a Regents diploma that was good as gold. And so things were tailored to where you wanted to go. You covered the vocational, you got your basic education, or you were college bound. And it seems we're trying to streamline everybody into one educational system to address all skill levels that are needed for where people are going to go after high school. We used to be there. Where did it go?
Well, actually, what we're proposing is very like what you're describing in New York. What we're proposing is that all kids, almost all kids, by the time they're 16, have a level of foundation skills that enables them to make a choice so that they can either go a vocational route, if they choose to do that, by going into a vocational program in a community college or a technical college, not unlike the BOCES that you're talking about
mm-hmm.
in New York State, or they can choose to go to a community college general education program, which is a transfer program focusing on academics on the assumption that they want to transfer then to the upper division of a four-year college, or they could stay in high school and enter an international baccalaureate program or an AP program intended to prepare them for admission to a selective college. So in that way, it's very like what you're describing. These kids would not be shunted into one or another of these options because they hadn't performed well enough to select another one. They would be making a genuine choice based on their interests, but they'd be going to institutions that specialized in what they wanted to do.
Well, and I think this type of system would also address those children who have dyslexias or learning disabilities.
Yes,
that
it would.
When they get through, they do have some place to go, and mm-hmm. the educational system would help tailor their education a lot easier.
Absolutely. This is our system would do exactly that.
Thank you very much. Thanks. I really enjoyed the program.
Well, we've talked about earlier callers raised the point that this to make the changes that you're talking about would certainly be challenging and difficult. Let us assume that those challenges and difficulties could be overcome. How long do you think it would take actually to do it? 10 years? 20 years?
Our report was predicated on 15 years.
15 years.
Might be more, might be less. It's very hard to say, but it's not something that can be done overnight. And that was the main point we were trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a quick fix to the situation we're in.
I'm interested in what sort of reception that you might have gotten to your report from. I know that there has been some skepticism expressed by the teachers' unions to what you have recommended. Have you heard from people who are involved in education, say at the state level, or from people in Congress, for example, that are that would say it's one of their big issues? What sort of reaction did you get?
Oh, well, the answer, we've talked to all those folks and many more. On the day that we released our report, the press interviewed people from Senator Ted Kennedy's office and Congressman George Miller's office there. They are respectively in charge of the education committees of the Senate and the House, both of whom were very positive about our report and suggested that the Congress would take a very close look at it. We have been talking to a number of people from state departments of education around the country, and many of them have expressed a very strong interest in talking to us further about the report. And yes, we have talked to folks in teachers' unions. In one state, we had a couple of hours with a teachers' union, and the conversation started off, I might say, with the teachers expressing some a lot of skepticism about the report, and this is largely because they had been told things about our report which simply weren't true, as, for example, that we were proposing to take away teachers' pensions, which is hardly the case. We are proposing that teachers' compensation systems be reformed and that teachers be provided with pensions roughly comparable to those offered to college teachers now through the TIAA CREF system set up for college teachers. It's a pension fund. And those pensions would provide less than many of the defined benefit programs that teachers now have. In return, their cash compensation would be much, much higher than it currently is. But we are proposing, and when we told the folks that we were talking with that what we had proposed was that teachers now teaching be offered a choice between the old system and the new system, they said, oh, that's not so bad. We can do that because in that system, nothing gets taken away from anybody without their permission.
We're pardon me for jumping in on you there, but we're just going to have to stop because we've come here to the end of the time. I do want to mention again that if people are interested in taking a look at this report or the executive summary, which is called Tough Choices or Tough Times, this is the report of the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. You can read the executive summary by going to skillscommission.org. on the web. Our guest this morning, Mark Tucker, president of the National Center on Education and the Economy, also vice chairman and staff director of the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Today's broadcast made possible with support from World Gourmet Foods, 120 Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington, featuring over 300 international gourmet cheeses and more. Daily tasting, an extensive Saturday tasting party with over 50 items. Information at 309-663-2222 or at worldgourmetfoods.com, bringing the taste of the world to Bloomington Normal. We're going to break for an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where in the wheat pit, we're seeing futures lower at mid-morning on a light profit-taking setback from Friday's gains. Traders are saying that declines in outside markets, including crude oil,